Hello, and welcome to Dungeon Crawlers Anonymous, a podcast about adventure games, RPG hybrids, and of course, dungeon crawlers. This is episode 004, and today we're going to be talking about all kinds of fun things. We've really stacked the event deck in your favor. We're going to be answering one of your burning questions. At the Mechanics Shop, we're going to be talking about action economy in adventure games, and we're going to wrap up talking about adventure slash crisis management game hybrid, Darkest Night from Victory Point Games. All that and more await you in today's episode of Dungeon Crawlers Anonymous. I'm Ron Reinhart.
And I'm Chuck Angelini.
And welcome to the dungeon. Hi, my name is Ron, and I'm addicted to dungeon crawlers.
Hi, Ron.
Ron?
Before we dive into our stuff today, I really wanted to talk about and gloat, honestly, about a recent event that Chuck and I both went to, which is it's area famous in that I know at least 20 people that have gone to this event, and that's Geekend.
Geekend.
That's our theme song. Geekend is a weekend excursion. Thus, and it's you can see it's a play on words there of geek and weekend. See what we did there? We're pretty proud of that. It is it's a weekend getaway where we rent a house on the Oregon coast for 3 nights, Thursday through Sunday, and basically we get out there and all we do is we eat good food, we drink a few beers, or some of us do, and we play lots and lots of board games, and it is a ridiculous adventure.
Ridiculous.
And it's interesting how Geekend has evolved over the years. It started off, originally it was literally an excuse to get Twilight Imperium on the table back in 2009. It's such an epic game, and I had both expansions. I bought the base game and both expansions in one go, and we decided we needed to rent a house to be able to play this board game, which is technically true.
That's valid.
It's like a 12-hour game.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And eventually, you know, it's evolved in a lot of ways, and I mean, it's kind of a mini con. You know, we get about 15 people, and everybody brings board games, and we have organized food events, and it's just this crazy adventure. And it's actually, I look forward to it now as not just a good getaway, but as my opportunity to play a whole bunch of games that I've never played before.
Yeah, and this last weekend there was a ton of them. So many new games this last weekend.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think the Gen Con wave hits around holiday, and so everybody loads up on all these big games from the year, and then we bring them all to Geekend in the early part of the following year, and it's pretty crazy. We had like almost nothing but new games hit the tables. So I just want to talk about a couple games. I have one that stuck out in my mind that I really enjoyed, which was it has a strange and storied history with me, which is A New Era. Which is actually a game I picked up in a trade several months ago and brought to a Geekend. I guess that was the Christmas Geekend last year.
Yeah, it was.
And I taught it to Chuck. Well, we sort of learned how to play it together, and then you kind of liked it, right?
Yeah, I liked it, but I was like, there's some things that seem off about this. You can't really get your economy going, and like it's really confusing because it's all iconography, so it's really hard to pick up and stuff. So I was enjoying it, but I was a little like, I don't know. There's a lot of like weird side things in this game.
But then you played it like three more times.
Then I played it like three. Well, okay. So there's the missing piece. There is that the next morning, I went to read the instructions on Board Game Geek. I wanted to like download them because it was all dark. I was the first one up, and I didn't want to bother anyone, so I was going to read on my phone. And then I saw that someone had put up, like, an instruction booklet that they had written, because the actual instruction booklet is kind of awful.
It is so bad.
And so I read that, and I was like, oh, so all of those things that sort of bothered me about the game are not even, like, how we should have been playing the game. So that makes sense. So then I played again that day, yeah, and then I played, three more times during Geekend, which is weird for me. Usually I don't, if it's a shorter game like Love Letter, maybe I'll play it a bunch, but to play a longer, like, hour, two-hour game like that multiple times in a geekend. Usually you just sort of do each game once to try out as many games as you can.
Right. Which, I mean, it really speaks to the game.
Yeah.
And I did not play in these three games. You played in three other games or two other games or something like that, and I did not play in them.
Yeah.
And then
we set up, and I taught the game, and then someone ran in and was like, we're going to play Super Fight. And Super Fight was like the new party game we had brought, you know, to this one. And so we were like, yeah, Super Fight. So we just totally abandoned that game and went and played Super Fight.
That's right. So anyway, I ended up, you know, like, Chuck, you liked it so much. I kind of gave you my copy and, you know, you got to hone your skills on there. And then I know you ended up picking up Imperial Settlers, which is kind of a spiritual successor in a lot of ways. Another Ignacy Trevicek game. Mm-hmm. And then, so anyway, at this last geekend, you actually ended up teaching me how to play A New Era. And I realized that, you know, I'd sat down and played it once and I had learned it a second time, but it was about halfway through that game that it actually really clicked with me as far as the mechanics. And it was a little demoralizing to play with you and Craig, who had played the game so many times. You guys were so good at it, knew the strategies. Kind of reminds me of like Race for the Galaxy, where you essentially have to learn the cards, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that you can identify what strategies are in there and be able to figure it mm-hmm. out. But the thing that's really cool about that game for me is just one. I think cards are probably my favorite like component in any board game. I just really love cards, mm-hmm. and any game that uses cards in a bunch of different ways, I think, is super cool. And that's clearly what that game's like original design purpose
yeah.
was: is to figure out how to use cards in as
yeah,
many
ways.
Yeah,
there's three possible. Different ways to play cards, and you can interact with other people's cards that are in their tableau. Like, there's just so many different things you can do. That's probably my number one thing for that too. And the cards are great too. I mean, the symbology is cool. The artwork is fantastic. I love the artwork on it.
Yeah, the theme is great. That's one thing about, like, so Race for the Galaxy, for example, I think it's an amazing game, but the theme is absolutely terrible, or it's very thin. Mm-hmm. But like in A New Era, or The New Era, is it The or
The.
Okay, in The New Era, the theme, it's not like evocative, I wouldn't say, but it's definitely interesting, and the mechanics of the cards really fit with the theme of the card, which I think is really cool. I really like when the mechanics are very tightly kind of coupled with the theme.
Right, right. Like, you have the torture chamber, for example, where every time you make an attack action, you get to draw a card. And so it's like you attacked, you brought a dude back, you tortured him for a bit, and you found out where a new location is, which every card is a location, you know, so that's kind of thematic.
Yeah, I've always wanted to have a game where I feel like I'm really torturing somebody for extra
information. Yeah, all of them are thematic in an awful way. I mean,
there's like
you attack someone's school, you know, and you get three people. So it's just terribleness.
So anyway, I'm not sure that was like my favorite game from Geekend this last time, but that one really stuck with me. It was just, it's got a good history, and I really like sort of deep, you know, strategic card games. Is really fun. How about you?
Obviously, I like that one. The biggest one for me was probably Tragedy Loopers.
Hmm.
And I don't want to talk about it too much because we're probably going to cover it in another episode.
Yeah.
During like our third topic where we go over an entire game. But it's definitely the most unique game I've played in a long time. It reminded me sort of Archipelago, where I sat down and I was like, nothing in this game is like something I've done before in a board game.
Yeah, it is.
It was just really, really cool. And the theme is awesome.
Yeah.
And it really felt like it too. Like, the theme really came through, because you spend... So I'll go over it a little bit. So in Tragedy Loopers, you're time travelers that are encountering these tragedies. And you don't know quite what the tragedy is when you start the game. You don't know what it is you're trying to prevent. So you're encountering this tragedy, and when you do, it sort of gives you a clue to what it is, and then the whole game basically starts over again. So you go through this time loop. I called it Groundhog Day the game.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So when, you know, the bad thing happens, the whole thing starts over again, and you only have so many tries to try and make the right thing happen. But even once you figure out what the bad thing is, you've got a game master who's working against you. So it's a team of three against one, like, evil tragedy mastermind person. And
that's the official role in the game, by the way.
That's the official role. That's what it's called.
It's a weird translation issue.
It's a Japanese game. Right. So even when you know what the tragedy is and you're trying to stop it, everyone's sort of, you know, the tragedy person and the time travelers are all playing their cards face down. So you don't quite know what's going to happen and you're sort of bluffing each other. So it's just, it's this really intense, you know, if you were watching a movie where people are trying to prevent tragedies, you're kind of on the edge of your seat the whole time. What's going to happen? And you just kind of felt that, like I felt that way the whole game. I was just like, on the edge of my seat. What is going to happen when they flip these cards over? Did I pick the right card to counter what the game master is doing, or is the person going to die again and we're going to have to start over?
Yeah, it's such a unique and cool theme, and the mechanics work so well for it, and it is very hard. So, you know, I had read the rules and read a couple write-ups and all the other stuff as the mastermind, but it is very hard to teach that game as a mastermind. It's just like, there's so much to think about and wrap your head around, and your strategy just has to be really sound. It's really interesting. It's very challenging. So I definitely want to try it again, but I really want to like study the game so that I can get a really good grasp for how everything works, so that I can, because it's hard to bluff, because you have to do a lot of bluffing as the mastermind.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to bluff unless I have a really strong understanding of what I'm actually faking you out on.
And it's so hard to learn too.
Mm-hmm.
Like that first time we were just like, what is going on?
Yeah.
We had figured, by the time we had finished, we were just like, oh, I want to play that again.
Yeah. It feels obtuse, but once you kind of get it, it really comes together pretty nicely. Yeah. It's a cool game for sure. All right. Well, let's move into our first segment. So we're going to be introducing a new segment in this episode, which is the DCA podcast mailbag. And disclaimer, this is 100% fake mailbag because nobody's sending us email yet. But in our mailbag segment, we'll be answering your questions. We've kind of invented a question here just as a good talking point, just because it's fun to kind of discuss these different things. So in this mailbag talking point is what should I buy? And the scenario is you want a one versus many style adventure game where you have one player that plays sort of an overlord or mastermind or something along those lines. And then the other players are heroes or another team. Essentially, it's a team-based game. And you'd like to be there to be a campaign in this, some sort of ongoing storyline or a series of quests that tie together in order to create a complete story. No real particular theme or setting that you want, just making sure that it's one versus many. So we're going to make suggestions based on that question. And Chuck, I'm actually going to let you go first.
Sounds good. So I would actually recommend, of the games I've played, would be Descent 2nd Edition. We talked about this in a previous episode. It's got all the pieces we're looking for. It's a one versus many. It's got a campaign. The campaign is very tightly designed and well put together. You play through one adventure at a time. You get to visit the town and shop for things between adventures. You earn experience and level up. It's essentially like playing a role-playing game, just the dungeoneering and looting and leveling up part of a role-playing game. It's everything but the actual role-playing, which is really cool. It's got a nice balance mechanic, so if the heroes are winning too much, you're going to do harder quests later on. If the overlord's winning too much, you're going to do easier quests, so it has a self-balancing thing there. And I believe it's three quests, an interlude, three quests, and then like a finale. So you know, you have an 8-quest campaign. Each quest is 2 scenarios, so you've got about 2 hours per play session. So that's, you know, even if you meet weekly, that's like a 2-month campaign, which is really good for a board game. So
absolutely.
I would go with that. The mechanics are really sound. It's really easy to learn how to play. Doesn't take very long. It has special dice, which sort of take care of a lot of the mechanics for you. And all of your abilities are on cards, and the cards just kind of tell you what to do. So it's also easy to learn, but there's a lot of depth to how you can build your character as you level up. You get to choose from a whole set of cards. to add to your character's ability. There's just a lot of options, a lot of cool stuff that game has going for it.
Cool. Great. Actually, went in a different direction with this one. I was thinking of Privateer Press has a game called Level 7 Omega Protocol, which is actually the second in their Level 7 series. Their first one, Level 7 Escape, is a fully cooperative, it's kind of a dungeon crawler where you're basically trying to escape from this like lab filled with aliens. It's very weird. The game is kind of cool. It's not great. It's clearly kind of like a first foray into board game design. I feel like it makes a few weird mistakes, but has an incredible theme. Very cool theme. The second game in the series, Omega Protocol, is a miniatures dungeon crawler, and it is really cool. I've only had a chance to play it once, so I didn't get to wrap my head around it too much, but I've thought about it all the time ever since. And the main reason why I would recommend this one over something like Descent is that the Overlord is very fun to play in Level 7 Omega Protocol. And in my experience, the Overlord wasn't as fun to play in Descent. It felt kind of like the game was balanced against you a little bit. Mm-hmm. So not to like bash on your pick, which is clearly what I'm doing.
It's fine. I'm okay.
The cool thing about Omega Protocol is you kind of get this grid as the Overlord of these different tiles. And every scenario has a different tile grid that are basically like your powers. And so the heroes go, and they're like these Marines that are breaking into this facility and trying to kill all the aliens and get to the heart of the problem. And, you know, there's kind of different scenarios. It doesn't really have like a campaign as far as your characters carry forward, but it is a full storyline. Like each one kind of tells a part of the story until you get to the climax. As you're kind of moving through this evil layer full of alien, like escaped alien lab monstrosities and stuff. So the players are these Marines, and they're running around, and they're basically using adrenaline to use all of their powers. And the whole theme in the game is that or in the universe, I guess I should say, is that the aliens actually feed off of the adrenaline of humans. And that's like why they've come to Earth, is to kind of like feed off of adrenaline. So essentially the balancing mechanic for actions is, the players go and they get to do, or the sort of the heroes, I guess, go, and they get to spend adrenaline to do different actions, like going into different poses, sorry, not poses, stances, like prone or running quickly, which kind of affects their stats. They can shoot their guns. They have these cool dice for the different gun effects. They can do melee attacks. They can search for specific items. They can do all this cool stuff. And then all of the adrenaline that gets spent gets put over into the Overlord's pool. And then the Overlord basically gets to spend all of that adrenaline, activating all these different kind of options in its grid. And the grid's like this puzzle board where you put all the different pieces together, and then that's like your action set for that particular scenario. So you can spend like 3 adrenaline to activate this type of creature, or you can spawn a creature, or you can spend adrenaline on special powers for the creatures, or special attacks against the Marines, all kinds of cool stuff. Really neat theme, and just a very unique way to play the Overlord. Definitely worth checking out.
That sounds like a really cool, I've never heard of kind of an action system mm-hmm. like that, where depending on how much the heroes do, the enemy gets to do that much. That's kind of a really neat idea.
Yeah, it's essentially, it's essentially like a risk reward where it's like, okay, I gotta spend this much adrenaline to be able to do this action. But if I succeed, it's really great. But even if I do succeed, like the Overlord gets that adrenaline to use on his turn, whereas the heroes can take like a short turn where they just rest. They don't generate a lot of adrenaline, and then the Overlord doesn't get a lot to do in response to that. It's very, very interesting.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and hey, speaking of action economy, that seems like a decent segue.
Yeah. So in today's mechanics shop, we're going to be talking about action economies in games. So when we talk about action economies, we're talking about the numbers and types of actions you get in a game. So there's all sorts of different types of action economies. In a Euro, there's the famous worker placement. You get to place a worker on a specific space and get that action. Other Euros, you just have a number of actions you can take and you get to choose one. Or like a game like Clash of Cultures, you take 3 actions and then that's the end of your turn. And everyone just kind of goes around that way. a couple of examples from adventure games. Is the Dungeons and Dragons adventure game is one of the more simple ones I've seen. You basically move and then use one of your powers, which you have a card for each power. You use a power and then move, or you move twice. That's it. Those are all of your options. But they add a little depth in that you've got all these different powers to choose from, and all the powers sort of do different things. Some of them are defensive, some of them are offensive, so they're not always attacks. So there's a little more choice there than it seems, but it's still a very simple action economy. In Descent, or sort of Darkest Night, which we're going to talk about later on the podcast, you basically have a list of possible actions, and you choose X number of actions. So whereas in Dungeons & Dragons, one of the actions is always going to be a move. And the other one is likely going to be an ability, though you can replace it with a move to get a double move. This, you might go through the whole game without taking one of your actions, which actually happened for most of the actions in Darkest Night. I think I used like two or three different actions the whole game.
Right.
Or Descent, your different actions. You can move, you can search for treasure, you can interact with quest objectives, and depending on kind of what role you have in the party, you might not even use some of those actions the entire game, and you'll just be doing some of them. And then Super Fantasy Ugly Snouts Assault. I haven't played this one, so Ron, you'll have to go through this example.
Yeah. So I was trying to think of one that had a really interesting or unique action economy, and that's this game definitely has it. In Super Fantasy Ugly Snouts Assault, which is really the name of the game, it's a dungeon crawler, and each hero gets six dice, and the dice are essentially D3s with a one space, two one spaces, two spaces, and two star spaces, the star being kind of a special ability. And you essentially assign dice to actions to try to do them. So you can do six actions on your turn with doing one dice per action, but you're not very likely to succeed. Essentially, a good example would be if you want to attack a creature, you could choose how many dice you want to spend on that attack, and the creature has a defense of, say, five, and you have no bonuses at this point. So you're like, well, I'm going to roll, if I could roll two dice and hope I get a two and a star, or I could roll three dice and have a better chance of kind of getting that five. So you can choose how many dice you actually want to spend on the action, then you roll them, and of course, you don't roll what you need, and the dice are all a waste, which can be very discouraging. But it's a very unique system. I actually really like it because it can be very flexible, where you can kind of risk, like, I just need this, and hopefully I can get it on two dice so that I have four dice left over to do this other action that I want to do on my turn. Or you can spend all of your dice just to make sure that you definitely succeed at a specific action. For example, at the very end of the first scenario, you need to do a magic action on this portal, and you have to get a total of six. So you just move your guy in there, and then you spend his next turn, boom, six dice. You're definitely going to get a six, and you're able to complete the scenario. So kind of a cool and unique action system.
Yeah, I think, is it Savage Worlds has something like that? I think each, that's an RPG, but each round in combat, you can't do the same action twice, but you can do as many actions as you want, but each one gets, you go like down one dice grade or something like that.
Interesting. I don't know.
So you can attack and cast a spell and do something else, but then you get worse and worse and worse at each thing the more things you do.
I like games that give you kind of like the option to do a lot of actions by kind of taking a hit on some of those actions. Because sometimes it's just like, God, I want to do more than just this one thing. You know, I want to do two things. And, you know, I'm even okay. I think I'd be happier trying to do two things and failing at one of them than I am just being able to do one thing guaranteed success. I don't know. It's kind of that option of choice, that illusion of choice or something along those lines. But
yeah. So now that we've gone through some examples, I just kind of want to talk about the pros and cons of each approach. So you've got kind of the simpler approach that we've talked about, which would be fewer actions. Or the more complicated approach, you have more actions you can do in a turn, or more variety of actions, or both. And I think having more actions on your turn, like you just said, can be fun for the player who's taking their turn. But often for everyone else, that just causes more downtime between turns.
Sure.
And the other problem I've seen with it is you take a game like Defenders of the Realm, right, where each character, depending on your class, you have a certain number of actions you can take. It's basically an action point system. So moving is a point and attacking is a point, and some things are 2 points, you know, if you're moving into like a dangerous area or something like that. And that becomes really problematic because you start to get into this like analysis paralysis where you're like, well, I can move 2, then attack those guys, and then move another 3,
mm-hmm.
or I can move 1 over there and attack those guys, and then move 1 and attack those guys. There's just so many different combinations of things you can do, and especially in like a crisis management game, that can start to get overwhelming on each person's turn. So then people kind of join in and start to help the person out, and you start to get this alpha gamer issue, right, where, you know, there's one person playing the game and the other 3 people are just sitting there doing what he says, because if they take too long to think, the most experienced person is just going to step in and be like, well, this is the most efficient path to victory or whatever.
Blech.
So yeah. So, you know, lots of actions are good, but also they can be bad, depending on the type of game you're playing in and depending on how long it takes to resolve the mechanics of those actions. Fewer actions can make the game feel very snappy. In games I've played, like Dungeons & Dragons or Darkest Night, where you have fewer actions, it just jumps from turn to turn, which feels awesome, and the game just goes by quick. You get to your turn almost all the time before you can think of what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside to that, obviously, is that you don't feel like, even though it gets around to you again really quickly, it's just weird not being able to do a lot in your turn.
Right.
So that can definitely make it feel a little limiting and not quite as heroic, which is what we like to feel in these types of games, adventure games. So and that's an interesting point, too. It can also affect the theme of the game. You know, if you want the heroes to feel like they're kind of not the powerful ones, it's not very high fantasy, you may want to limit the action economy to sort of raise the stakes, make things seem more dangerous, or make it seem like their environment is frightening, more powerful than they are. Or if you want them to feel great, you know, you give them lots of actions and they can go out and just murder a bunch of things in one round, and it feels awesome.
Both of those sound pretty fun. Well, that's actually yet another really good segue into our next topic, which is our game of the week. So this week we're going to be talking about Darkest Night, which is a crisis management adventure game hybrid, is the best way I could describe it. This is a game from Victory Point Games. It plays 1 to 4, although it plays 1 to 4, but you always have 4 heroes in the game. So if you're playing solo, you have to manage 4 different characters, which isn't horrible. I know some people really don't like when a solo game requires you to, you know, manage more than one kind of character. But the game is very clearly balanced around having 4 players. For characters. So, for example, if you play with 3 people and only play with 3 characters for half the game, which happened literally yesterday, it can feel a little overwhelming until you add that 4th character and you're like, oh, you know, this isn't so bad. Oh, it's still tough, but it's not quite as difficult as we were trying to make it.
We were getting killed.
We were. It was not looking good for a while. But a 2-hour playtime on this game, it's from Victory Point Games, which is, if you don't know, they're a U.S. production company. And they actually do all of their production in-house. When you order a game from them, if you order direct, they actually go and print the game right there. So it takes a little longer to get a game from them, but you're literally getting it like fresh off the press, which I think is really cool. I love that they're local, or not local, but they're like U.S. made. I think that's really neat. I like supporting that company. So as a little introduction to Darkest Night, essentially a crisis management game where you're playing heroes who are... The general way that this was sold to me and the way that I think it works pretty well is essentially it's Frodo and Sam moving through Mordor before they're able to destroy the ring. So essentially kind of Sauron has won. He's this evil necromancer in the game, and he moves around sort of the dilapidated ruins of the once fabulous human settlement or country. and you have to sneak around as the heroes. You don't get very many actions. You're not very powerful. You have like the secrecy stat you have to manage to try to keep the necromancer from noticing you, which I think is super cool. Very unique theme, kind of where you're like kind of doing this subtlety, subterfuge style crisis management, essentially. And I think what really gives it the adventure game feel, besides a really well-executed theme, is every character has a unique kind of deck of powers. And you start with 3 starting powers. But as you progress through the game, you can actually draw more cards from your deck. Everybody has 10 cards, including their starting cards, and kind of build out these extra powers. And all the heroes play very differently, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, often you'll have, in crisis management games or adventure games, you'll have different characters, but they're usually static. This is probably the first crisis management where I've seen this whole deck of cards that you can build into. You know, the character can get more powerful as you go. And a lot of games will give you, like, you pick up an item or you complete a quest, which gives you, like, a one-time use special power or something like that. But it comes from, like, a generic deck. You usually don't have your own deck that you're drawing from. So as you get more powerful, you get more powerful in the way that your character is powerful.
Yeah. I learned about this game by watching a Rotto video. He played through, and I was like, oh, crisis management, it's just not my favorite. It feels too high pressure sometimes. I don't really like that it's very lends itself to kind of alpha gamer stuff. But when he started kind of pulling out these decks of different characters, and each character works very differently, where instead of just having one special power, they have a variety of special powers and completely different ways that they contribute, I became more and more sold. And then he pulled out the artifact deck, which I have a weakness for treasure stacks, as it's probably well known by now. I became more and more sold on the game. And having played it now twice, I really like it. I'm not a huge fan of crisis management, except for, you know, really high meta games like Battlestar Galactica. But Darkest Night, I think, is fantastic. I think it's a fantastic game.
I think one of the things that really sets it apart for me was it really has a strong theme. And most crisis management games I've played, for as much as they try to put a theme there and there's artwork and everything that really lends well to the theme, at the end of the day, you feel like you're solving a puzzle together. That's just sort of how crisis management games worked.
Right.
Whereas with this game, because of the different things that they did in the game, it just felt more like an adventure. It wasn't obvious that, like, okay, if we don't manage this space, like, we're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many things. I guess, like, everything felt really dangerous individually, but, like, board-wide, it didn't feel like we were always one turn from losing, like it does in a crisis management game. Like, I always felt like I was one turn from getting destroyed by, you know, the necromancer who's chasing us around and stuff. But I didn't always feel like we were one turn away from losing the game. So the other thing they did is, you know, most games in Pandemic, you have these generic cube disease things that you're taking out, and the action to take them out is the same regardless of which disease they are. There's a little bit of variety in Defenders of the Realm. The different monster types take different die rolls to kill and things like that. But this had how many different negative things that could go on the spaces?
Yeah, so the version of the game I picked up is the Necromancer Edition, which includes the first 2 expansions. And so I think we had, I think there's like 20 different blight types that can be spawned on the board.
Yeah, and so some of them are monsters. Some of them are like creepy auras that you got to get rid of. And the cool thing about the blights is every single blight affects the space in some way. So if you're on a space with a blight, if you don't attack it, you have to deal with the consequences of that blight at the end of the turn. And, you know, this is something that happens in other games. Like in Defenders of the Realm, if you end your turn on a spot with monsters, they're going to attack you at the end of the turn. But this, like, every blight was different. And so one blight would have, you know, there were like the crows who would drain your secrecy so that the bad guys would come and get you faster. There were other ones, you got to draw an event each turn, and there's one that, you know, makes you draw two events and do the one that's worse. And so each one had a, you know, they weren't necessarily all just dealing damage to you. Each one had a different thing it was doing. And the thing that it's doing is written on the little piece that you put on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like you have to reference a bunch of stuff, which was nice too. It's just right there. It could have been really complicated, right? They could have just had a symbol that you then had to look up somewhere else, but they put it right on the piece. Which, you know, there's all this depth, but it's not a lot of complexity because it's right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was so thematic, because as you went from place to place, like, you had to be careful, because, yeah, I can kill things, but if there's something that's going to get rid of my secrecy, like, I'm not very good with secrecy, and the necromancer is going to come and murder my face. So I can't mess with the crows. I got to go kill the zombies and the liches and stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, you're kind of touching on a couple points that really help kind of illustrate why I like the game. And another one of them is that, you know, like you were saying, it doesn't feel, it's just not that tight of a game. And for some people, like crisis management vets, that might be a turnoff that the game isn't super tight, doesn't feel like you're losing every turn. You might be unselling certain people on the game, right? But for me, I just sit down to play a game to relax and have fun. And it doesn't need to be this high pressure puzzle that I need to solve, and with the amount of random elements and the different types of blights and all other stuff, and just the random nature of how the necromancer moves around, it makes the game less tight from a puzzle perspective, but more fun from just a moving around trying to solve the problem of getting rid of the necromancer, which is more enjoyable for me.
Yeah, and it feels much more thematic.
Yeah,
you actually feel like you're adventurers in this dark land, the last bastions of light that are, you know, going around and kind of just eking out a victory against the darkness. It really sells the theme well. And one of the ways it does that is you only get one action on your turn.
Right.
But the thing I actually liked about that, one action seems small. When I first looked at that, I was like, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to like this game. But as we went around and played, a turn would go by so fast that it mm-hmm. would get back to you. And one of the things I often don't like about crisis management games is one person will take a turn, and then the game takes a turn and terrible stuff happens. And then another person takes a turn, and a game takes a turn. And it always seems like when the game takes a turn, it's doing more than that one player did.
Right.
So you just feel like you're getting further and further behind as you go. And I liked the fact that all four players act, and then the game would take its turn. And, you know, sometimes a lot of things would happen when the game takes its turn, but at least you felt like you had time to respond to it. Because yeah. Sometimes games, you know, the wizard will act, and then the game will take its turn, and stuff will come out that the wizard's really good at countering, and you're like, oh, but the wizard doesn't go for another three turns, and the game's going to have another three turns to put out terribleness before the wizard can deal with what just came out, and we have to deal with what just came out now, and we wish we had the wizard to deal with that, but, you know, it just, plus the downtime that it adds, right? If someone's going, and then the game's having a turn three times in between each of your turns, that can be a lot of downtime, but there was almost no downtime in this game at all.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, what's interesting is the character that I was playing, the knight, has these oaths, and you have to spend an action to turn on the oath, and then if you basically, once you benefit from the oath, it becomes deactivated. And so one of them I had was like killing a blight. It gives you an extra, or you get better at killing blights, and then once you kill a blight, it becomes deactivated and you get a heal. And at first, since this was only my second game of playing it, I was like, man, this is great, but like I have to spend every other turn reactivating this thing. But as we were kind of digging into the game, and like you're saying, how quickly it moves and how it's really not that punishing to take your turn, basically prepping for what's going to happen next turn. And, you know, or if you just, it feels bad at first to have your whole turn be, I move, and that's my turn. But as you play through it, and, you know, you kind of realize that the pace is pretty quick and it's not particularly punishing for you to spend a few turns kind of setting up for something, it kind of balances itself out.
Right. But that still won't convince me to play The Prince again.
Oh, The Prince was horrible. Yeah, that's...
And you know there's someone out here who's, like, has played The Prince and is, like, an ace at it, and, it, you know, is able to buff his team up and they win every time. But man, I just, the Prince just seemed awful.
Bring it. If you know how to play the Prince and kick butt in Darkest Night, please let me know. DCIcast@gmail.com. Like, cause we, you know, we had the Prince out there, and that's one of the things about the Necromancer bundle. It comes with like 16 characters, and, I don't know how well balanced they all are. But the Prince who Chuck picked, because that's, I mean, if you need to know anything about
it, was
how
very
Chuck
different.
That's, yeah. That's the way Chuck plays games. Like, oh, the Prince, I want to play that in this Adventure Crisis Management game where we're fighting the Necromancer.
Because it literally says, like, he can't fight, but he, you know, rallies other people, and he's not good at hiding, so the Necromancer's always going to chase him down. And I was like, well, this sounds kind of terrible, but something's like got to balance that out, right? It's got to balance out the terribleness. I just like the non-standard characters. Right. It's always interesting to me, but it just didn't work out.
Yeah. I mean, he was kind of a liability, and maybe there are a couple effects that he can use. And, you know, maybe as you get more efficient with the game or we learn it better, like, his powers become more obvious, the benefits.
Right.
But as first-time players, you know, it was not super obvious. And then when you got the Scholar out, who's just, like, super great at searching and can pick up two cards instead of one, and it suddenly was just, like, you were so useful by comparison.
Yeah.
It was just very clear that there
and
was
that's
kind
the
of
Scholar who literally, like, all he could do was search. He was kind of useless in everything else. But even he was better than the Prince.
Yeah. The poor Prince. Anyway, that's Darkest Night by Victory Point Games. Really fun kind of hybrid adventure game, crisis management game. Definitely check it out. All right, well, I think that about wraps it up, unless you have anything else you'd like to add, Chuck?
Nope.
Okay. All right, well, thanks, as always, for listening. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen to our podcast. If you have any feedback, we'd love to hear it. We're still learning, obviously, and growing and figuring out how to do this. So you can leave a comment on the blog. You can leave a comment. You can tweet at us at DCAcast, or you can email us at DCAcast@gmail.com. Yeah, thanks so much for listening. And next week, you can look forward to Chuck and I rambling on about Pathfinder Adventure Card Game.
It's going to be good.
It will probably be good. Intro music. Da-da. Hey Chuck,
sorry,
how you doing
sec
today? Oh, nope, all right.